everybody. Thank you for coming on this sort of blustery February evening. It's great pleasure I introduce our speaker tonight, who is Dr. Fred Ayres, who is the chairman of the Lancaster's Beekeepers Association. He's going to talk about the honeybee. It's very relevant to flora because we are intent on sowing a bee-friendly mix in the hedgerows of the big fields there. So I think that we are hoping that we will learn something about what we can do. Thank you.
Thank you. Well, good evening, everyone. It seems quite strange to me talking about bees at this time of year because they're all tucked up nicely in bed, hibernating from the bad weather, and probably won't start showing in any consequence until for another couple of months. But I'd like to talk to you tonight about, has the honeybee the future? As you probably know, over the last 25 years, this country has lost 80% of its honeybee stocks. That's both natural and maintained. So there is a very serious problem out there, which unfortunately doesn't seem to be getting very much better. Some facts about honeybees. Honeybees pollinate 60% of all commercial crops in this country. Apples, pears, strawberries, peas, field beans, it goes on and on. Rape, which is one of the big crops. And they contribute over £400 million annually to the economy. And 70% of the pollination of winter forage for small furry animals and birds comes from the efforts of bees in the hedgerows. So they do make quite a contribution. Now, we haven't counted 6 billion bees. We just estimate how many there are based on the number of colonies that we've got. And until somebody contradicts us, we're sticking to about this sort of figure. But unlike the rest of the developed world, 95% of the honeybees in this country are maintained by hobbyist beekeepers. There are very few commercial beekeepers in the UK. And that puts us on a collision course straight away with DEFRA. Because DEFRA is all about food production, and they want the hobbyists to do things which, quite honestly, the hobbyists have absolutely no interest in doing. And I'll explain a little more about that later on. The population, as I say, is declining about 25% year on year and continues to do so. Now, the main reasons for the decline, and they're contentious, there's lots of them, but the main ones are, firstly, the reduction of forage due to farming practices. I came up by train from London the other day to Lancaster, and every single field was brown. There wasn't anything growing at all. It was all ploughed, almost all the way from London until you started getting to just south of Preston. And that's because of changes in farming practices. The other thing that's causing a big problem is the UK obsession with closely mown grass. It's everywhere. I was on an industrial estate doing some work back in the summer, 27 acres of it, of which 7 acres were occupied by factory and 20 acres was closely mown grass, which the company that owned it mowed 3 times a week. Dread to think of the cost of that. The third use is the extensive use of pesticides. And again, this is where we as beekeepers find ourselves head-on collision with the farmers. You no doubt heard the debate on neonicotinoids, a systemic pesticide which actually works wonders for the crops. They soak the seed in it, first of all, so they don't have to spray the crop later on. The insecticide spreads throughout the plant, and when a pollinator lands on it, some of that passes into the pollinator through the nectar. The argument used in the UK farmers was, because the bees don't drop down dead, it can't harm them. In actual fact, the clue's in the word systemic, it gets into the bee and builds up. And the other thing we're now finding, it actually destroys the bee's navigational system. So they go out and they find the plant, but can't find their way home. Fortunately, there's a moratorium at the moment, which, again, the UK government voted against the moratorium, but it's been imposed by Europe. And for the next 3 years, there's a reduction in the use of commercial neonicotinoids. There is not any restriction on the use of neonicotinoids for hobbyist gardeners. And if you go into any garden centre and look at the pesticides, you'll find most of them contain neonicotinoids. We've suffered in the past from a declining population, as I mentioned, and the results, when there's a declining bee population, people bring in bees from foreign countries. There is no restriction on importing bees from anywhere in the EU. Australia, New Zealand, and until quite recently, of all places, Hawaii. The problem we have with that is the honeybee, the western honeybee, Apis mellifera, has about 20 subspecies. Only one is native to the UK, Mellifera mellifera, which is the British black bee. The problem is all of these subspecies, bar one, will interbreed. And when people imported them, they tended to import either Italian bees, which are the bright yellow ones as opposed to our black ones, or the Carniolan bee, which is the bee found in Central Europe. Now, both of these bees are wonderful bees in their own environments, but in our environment, they don't do well, particularly in the northwest, except they work well during a good summer and die out during the winter. But two other things, they bring in disease. In the last 20 years, we've had three diseases imported into the UK which were never in the UK prior to that. And the other thing we're finding is when the subspecies interbreed, the next generation of bee is exceedingly bad-tempered. Now, bad-tempered bees can be managed, but they're not at all pleasant, so we've got some problems. And then, of course, we have the thing called weather. I'll explain in more detail why that's a particular problem with beekeeping, but it is causing us some problems at the moment, and not just the current one. What can we do about it? Well, over the years, the farmers, particularly in this part of the world, their main crop is grass. And they've enriched the land to get greater and greater crops of grass. And in fact, last year, in the farms around where I live, they took off 3 or 4 silage crops. So they're cutting it very short. They're making silage, and I really don't know how they make silage. It's a bit like pickling grass, I understand, but they cut it short, which does mean that there are no flowers in the fields at all. The second thing is, the native wildflowers, by and large, grow in impoverished soils. So even if there wasn't any grass, they wouldn't grow, because the soil's too rich for them. And thirdly, the new breeds of grass, which they grow for pasture, are very vigorous strains and will crowd out just about any weeds. They've been designed to do that. So that's a problem we have. The second thing we've seen is a reduction in hedgerows and poorly managed hedgerows. A lot of them have been grubbed out, and the hedgerows form the connecting links for animals and insects to move around in. And one of the things that we're noticing with these wonderful schemes that are springing up around the country to make new hay meadows is, unless they can be connected somehow, the populations of insects and whatever interbreed and eventually die out. It needs the interconnection. I'm not a biologist, but this is the wisdom that's coming out from all the scientific research that we've got. And the third thing is monoculture. Last year, and I did it, I flew in a light aeroplane from Hull to King's Lynn, and then down to the port. Forget the name. The whole of the East Coast was yellow. The whole of the East Coast was yellow with rape. It's a big commercial crop, and we're not going to stop that. But bees, and this is the problem with the American bee, is if you were fed bananas for 6 months, I wonder what you'd look like at the end of it. I would almost warrant that you won't be very healthy. And we've seen time after time that bees need nectar from a variety of plants if they're going to actually sustain and live well. What can we do about it? Well, the government has a scheme for wildlife corridors. which basically encourages the farmer to leave a strip of up to between 2 and 6 metres wide on either side of a hedge to form these corridors. It's not been widely taken up, and I'm not quite sure why, because this year they've actually increased the amount they pay the farmers to leave it. So they're getting as much for having the corridor now as they do for growing grass, certainly in this part of the world, but still there hasn't been a great deal of take-up. So anything you can do to persuade a farmer to build a wildlife corridor really would be extremely helpful, because, as I say, they are the corridors, they form the links, which are quite important. Here's an example of a corridor up the middle of a field. In actual fact, there is a drainage ditch running up the middle of there, which he's left, because he can't plough too near without collapsing the ditch, he's left it, and there's wildflowers on the other side of it. So it can be done. Obsession with mown grass. We've had numerous discussions with the Highways Authority, who until recently always insisted in cutting right up to the hedge and sometime into it. They've actually now agreed they'll only cut the first metre. So if you've got more than a metre in width, they will leave it. So that's something that we're perhaps winning the battle on. Publicly owned amenity land is a problem. I'm talking about the local authorities, the parks. Trained British park keepers in this country see parks in two ways: flower beds and mown grass. And the flower beds they plant are to give colour, and they're normally F1 hybrids. And F1 hybrids, as a generalisation, don't produce nectar, so are totally useless for bees or pollinators. I was asked to contribute to a programme that Radio Lancashire gave out a couple of years ago. It was in an Easter garden. This is near Preston. The garden looked spectacular. There was flowers everywhere, and not a single pollinator to be seen, because they were all hybrids and didn't produce nectar. So that's really quite important when you're looking at that. And then, as I mentioned earlier, you've got industrial estates. They're everywhere. They're one of the largest landowners in the country, collectively, and they mow their grass because they think that's what looks neat and tidy. Possible solutions? Well, we have actually had quite a big breakthrough with United Utilities. Now, they own a vast amount of land, and they have agreed, they've got a 5-year programme to seed all their plots, unless there is a health and safety reason for not doing so. And one of the reasons, I don't quite understand it, but where they have a covered reservoir grassed over, which they mow, apparently for health and safety reasons, they can't grow wildflowers in it. Having said that, I'm not knocking them, because we've made tremendous progress. They've done this year their budget is $2.65 million, and next year they said there'll be $14 million spent on plots to seed them. And the nearest one to us is going to be the sewage works just south of the university. So progress is being made, but it's very, very slow. This is United Utilities headquarters near Warrington, or part of it. And they've given up their grass. Took us 2 years of pestering to get them to do it, but they've done it. And of course, they're saving money and it looks nice. That actually is in Rylands Park. Now, we've been doing a lot of work with the authority, local council, to try and get them to do things. At the moment, they're still talking about pilots. And this was a pilot they did in Rylands Park last year. One of the problems we find when we're talking to local authorities is professionally trained gardeners look for colour and aren't always aware of A, native plants, and we're quite keen they should be natives, and secondly, they're nectar producing. Not all wildflowers produce nectar, by the way, and getting the ones that do is really quite important. As a club, some of our members have done an awful lot of research into this, and we've now got vast lists of native plants, which we'd happily share with you if you're interested in that. It might give you help on what you're trying to do. There's just another example. There's been a lot of schemes in Cumbria, wildflower meadows planted. Some of them were quite spectacular last year. Again, the difficulty is at the moment they're all individual patches and there's no corridors linking them. And if we can get the farmers to link up these patches, we'll be doing very well indeed. Pesticides, I've mentioned. Neonicotinoids are the worst. but they kill the pollinators over a period of time. One of the arguments that came up when the scientists were talking about the ban was lack of conclusive evidence. And they all agreed that what they would do was to go out and test the effect of neonicotinoids on wild bumblebees. And the typical scientific experiment, you have the ones that are affected by the whatever you're testing for, and the control group, it isn't. They could not find any bumblebees in the UK which were not affected by neonicotinoids. And because of that, perversely, they said, you can't produce the evidence that they're harmful, therefore we presume that they're not. I'll say no more about that, or I'll get quite angry. Foreign importations. Until 1923, importations of foreign bees into the UK was virtually unknown. And then somebody in the Isle of Wight had the brilliant idea they would bring in some Italian bees. They thought they'd work quite well in the Isle of Wight. They produced a disease which we now know was Acarin, but actual fact was it was nicknamed at the time Isle of Wight disease, which spread through the UK over the period of the next 3 years and reduced the UK bee population, the native bee, almost to extinction. As a result, they went out, this is DEFRA again, or DEFRA's predecessor, and imported vast numbers of foreign bees from the very source that the first ones came from. Fortunately, that disease has now been virtually stamped out in the UK. But the two bees we've got, so the Italian bee and the Carniolan bee. But the latest, well, American foulbrood was one of the diseases that they brought in, which is now a notifiable disease. It's not treatable. You have to destroy the whole colony and burn the hive it's in if you get it. It's in North Cumbria. It's not in South Cumbria or Lancashire. And the reason it's in North Cumbria was North Cumbrian beekeepers bought some bees from Scotland, not knowing that the bees were not Scottish, they'd actually been imported from Spain. So fortunately it's been held north of Penrith at the moment. We haven't got it here. Because one of the things we've campaigned heavily about as a club is to persuade people not to bring bees into our area, and we've pursued that by setting up a breeding apiary, which is just north of Carnforth, Yelland Conyers, where we are breeding sufficient stocks at the moment to supply local beekeepers with local bees well suited to the local environment, which are healthy. But that's been quite a big task. In 1992, we got an unwelcome visitor from the Far East in the form of this mite called Varroa. First detected near Exeter in 1992. It had possibly been there for a bit longer. It is now endemic throughout England, Wales, most of Scotland, not the islands, and we're almost certain it's in Ireland, north and south, although the Southern Irish are denying it vigorously. It's certainly in Northern Ireland, and it'll spread if it's not there already. And this is a particularly nasty mite. It attaches itself onto the bee. It's changed its characteristics somewhat. It's endemic on the Asian bee, but the Asian bees cope with it quite well. When it came over here, it switched from inhabiting the female bee to inhabiting the male bee. It sucks body juices and reduces the strength of the bee, but then bees normally carry six different viruses which are endemic and they're normally kept in equilibrium. This strange mite kills five of them, which then encourages the sixth one to explode its population and kill the bee. So it's quite bizarre, and there's been a lot of research. It's about, there's a slide there which shows it in relation to a match head. In relation to the size of a bee, it's a bit like you having a dinner plate stuck on your belly. So it's quite a sizable parasite relative to the size of the bee. Now, to understand how the weather affects bees, we really need to look a bit at the life cycle of a bee. In a colony, we have three types of bee. We have the female bee, who's larger than the rest. There's only one female bee in a colony, and she has the ability to lay fertilized and unfertilized eggs. I'll come back to that in a moment. The worker bees, which, strange enough, are all female, can lay unfertilized eggs. And then we've got the male bee. Male bee's sole duty in the hive is to mate with a virgin queen. And they die immediately afterwards. And those that don't succeed and hang around the hive for the rest of the season get booted out in the autumn and die off anyway. The queen will start to lay eggs normally about mid-January, a few eggs. And around April or May, she'll be at her maximum lay, which will be around about 2,000 eggs a day. So by the time we get to the back end of May, early June, there's anywhere between 40 and 60,000 bees in a colony. And then the bees normally do something quite special. They decide, they split. So they'll produce an egg, it's a fertile egg, which the worker bees will treat very differently. They'll build a larger cell for it, they'll fill it with royal jelly, and in 10 days' time, that will hatch out into a virgin queen. Before that happens, the old queen and half of the bees in the colony will fly away and find a new site and start a new colony. Obviously, if it's bad weather, that gives them a problem. But the real issue there is the virgin queen has to go out on a mating flight within 3 weeks of hatching, or she cannot mate at all. When she goes out, she'll mate with anywhere up to a dozen bee males at the time, and perhaps go for anywhere up to a dozen mating flights. The point is, if it rains solidly for the 3 weeks around when she's hatched, she will not survive. Or at least she'll survive, but she won't be able to lay eggs. And that colony then hasn't got a queen, so they can't lay any more eggs, and it will die. So a lot of the losses come from the fact that the queens can't get out to get mated during that period of time. If you've got questions, please shout out. It's not a lecture, I'd like you to join in.
Can I just ask on that topic, how far from the original site will the queen fly? And how far in general do... I'm thinking in the context of the rate of spread of the diseases that you're talking about.
Okay. Two separate questions there. Let me deal with the second one first. Bees have a GPS system. They locate on their hive, and they'll fly round the hive for a radius of about 3 miles. Actually, if you move the hive 3 feet, more than 3 feet to one side, they won't find it again. So when we're moving colonies of bees, we have a rule. Less than 3 feet, more than 3 miles. If you move them more than 3 miles, they come out of the hive and you can see them. It's almost as if a puzzle looks on their faces. Oh, where am I? And they fly around the hive for a few hours until they actually relocate themselves. So the foraging is 3 miles radius. The mating is a bit different. We don't know how it works in principle, but there are areas which we call male congregation areas, drone congregation areas. And there's no hereditary passing on. Bees can't teach each other because they only live a short period of time. The males seem to instinctively know where this area is, and every bee within about, male bee drone, within about 10 miles will fly to this drone congregation area. The virgin queen hatches, and within a day, strengthening her wings, she seems to know where it is and goes there to get mated. And that will be up to 10 miles.
Does she only mate with drones from her own colony?
Nope. There's all these males, drones flying around in the air. It takes place about 150 feet up, and it has been filmed. And the queen's flying to that, and there's a huge melee, and somehow they all get together, and she comes back home. Well, that's one way of putting it. It does mean that bee breeding genetics are exceedingly complicated. Because by the time the queen comes back, she might have mated with anywhere up to 100 different drones. She carries the sperm in her body for the rest of her working life. She can choose whether she lays a fertile egg which hatches out into another female, or an unfertile egg which hatches out into a drone. But once she loses up her store of sperm, she's useless in the colony and they'll kill her. It's a wonderful life being a bee, really. So that's one problem. Bad weather preferences. The second problem we have, and I'll come back to the honeybee cycle in a moment, is bees, well, perhaps I won't. Bees normally live during the summer for about 6 weeks. And they don't die as we die, they just wear out. So for the first up to 6 days, they've got a domestic job, they're in the hive, they're cleaning this out, doing a lot of general duties. Between 3 and 9 days, they're involved in feeding the young bees. Then they'll go on to attending the queen. Then they'll go on to honey processing. When the foraging bees come to the hive, they've got nectar stored in their honey stomachs. They pass this on to bees at the entrance, because there are guard bees there to stop unwanted ones getting in. They'll then transfer, well, they'll churn the nectar up in their stomachs and mix it with enzymes. They put it into cells. A different group of bees will evaporate the liquid off the cell until they get to the right sort of consistency. Then they'll seal it with a wax coat. Once sealed, that will stay there absolutely perfectly for a long time. When I say a long time, honey comb, sealed comb, has been taken out of the pyramids. So it's at least 4,000 years old in perfectly edible condition. So once they've sealed it, if they don't seal it, or they don't get the amount of water out of it, it basically ferments, makes mead, which makes the bees very sick indeed. Makes me sick, actually. I don't like the stuff at all. Another crucial thing in this is wax production. As you know, honeycomb is made out of wax, which the bees produce. But they can only the young bees can produce it. So they can only produce wax up until about 20 days old. So everything in the bee cycle is quite time critical. And if they can't do whatever function they've got within that period of time, they can't do it. So once the 20 days have passed, bees lose the ability to produce wax. Then they go into the outside for a bit, and they're involved in hive ventilation and guard duties. Now, perhaps I should say a word or two about that. The bees, during their active season, which in this part of the world is normally between about March and October, maintain the hive at a constant temperature, at a constant humidity, and there are at least 6 pheromones in there which they also control. So it's a very, very strictly controlled environment that the bees keep. And then after 20 days, they start to become foraging bees. And they'll fly anywhere up to 3 miles looking for sources of nectar. You've all heard of the waggle dance, which is a way of communicating how the bees tell other bees where the best sources of nectar are. And contrary to popular opinion, they don't collect all sorts of nectar. They definitely have a pecking order. For example, if you've got an orchard full of pears and there's dandelions in the grass, forget about the pears. The bees will go for the dandelions first. Equally, things like hawthorn, which we see in vast quantities in the hedgerow, don't always produce nectar. It depends on the humidity and temperature. So if you had a very cold spring and the hawthorn blossoms, the bees won't go to it because it's not producing nectar. So it's quite a complicated thing. And if you're planting plants, as I know you're going to do, getting a wide cross-section of pollinators, nectar-producing plants, is really quite important because they may not all produce nectar in any given year. And then eventually, the bees just wear themselves out. The one exception is when we get to October, and the bees that hatch out in September are what we call the winter bees, and they are the ones that will, during the winter, huddle together. They don't technically hibernate, they huddle into a ball about the size of a rugby ball, and they basically just move around in that and keep themselves warm until the whole process starts again when it gets a bit warmer.
Do they have to feed at all in that time?
Sometimes they do and sometimes they don't. But the issue is, we try to get them going into the winter with a strong colony, disease-free, with lots of stores. And they can eat honey during the winter, but they can't eat liquid feed because they can't evaporate the water off. So, again, it's quite technical. It's honey or honey substitutes that they can eat during the winter, provided it's not too cold. If it gets too cold, they'll just huddle and they won't move. And actually, that's a good thing. One of the worries we have with the winter we've had, which hasn't been particularly cold, is because it hasn't been cold, the bees will have been moving around, and they may or may not have stores in at the moment. And we've seen, particularly in Cumbria over the last few years, bees starving in March because they've expanded their numbers but haven't had the food and can't get out to get it. So feeding is quite critical. Getting them into the winter with sufficient stores to see them through. And then hope that very cold two winters we had a few years back were wonderful for the bees, at least for my bees. They went into the winter well fed. It was too cold for them to meet. They came out very hungry in February. They munched all the stores then very quickly, but then they were out. So that worked well for them. These long wet winters don't work too well at all.
When a bee dies, where does it go to do it? Presumably they don't die in the hive.
Well, some do die in the hive. And one of the duties of the cleaning bees is to bring out the dead. And in fact, most of us notice, if you get up during the summer early, just as the sun's coming out, you'll see the worker bees checking out the dead bees, and we have a blackbird who sits underneath the hives and picks them up. I mean, so when you go in the spring, there'll be some dead bees in there which we'll clean out. But normally, most of these die on the foraging flights outside and just don't come back.
You haven't mentioned pollen and feeding regime or use.
Pollen and nectar, water, are the three essential things they've got to have. Pollen largely comes from trees, to be honest, rather than plants. The commonest one around here is sycamore, which is quite good for pollen. But if you've got a horse chestnut tree, a large one, it's like having a whole meadow in your back garden, because that gives off an awful lot of pollen. But most of the pollen comes from trees. They don't seem to use grass-based pollen. Our club apiary is next to a field of maize, and we rarely see the bees collecting pollen off the maize, even though the maize flowers are absolutely full of it. You get your hands yellow.
Is it mixed with the nectar in the crop, and therefore gone into the...
No, they tend to collect it separately. The nectar comes in their honey stomachs. I have a special stomach. The pollen comes in little sacks on their legs. They do mix it up. They feed the young bees a thing we call bee bread, but it's a mixture of honey and pollen. But they do need both to actually survive. It's a bit like carbs and protein, I suppose. They've got to have both. Pollen, in this part of the world, has never been a problem, to be honest. It's the nectar that seems to give us the shortages. That's not true everywhere, it just happens here. So, a bee in an ideal situation will live up to about 26 weeks. One of the problems we get, and this is the weather-related thing, is if the winter goes on and on and on and on, and the bees can't get out in the spring, they will start dying off before the queen gets laying again, and then there won't be enough adult bees left to look after the new bees that are hatching. So those are the two critical weather-related things that we have. The length of the winter to get them out again, and the queen's getting mated. Everybody's looking terribly puzzled at that, but... We are fighting back. This is a shot of our club apiary. We started building it just over 4 years ago. It's cost us just short of £80,000 at the moment, which is coming from something like we've got just over 100 members. We've had working parties going on. It's actually wonderful. I learned how to drive a digger because we built our own road when we went into this. So that was quite fun. And we've got two main purposes with this. Firstly, we are training new beekeepers. 5-6 years ago, we were doing 100 beekeepers a year. Now it's a trickle of about a dozen each year. But we do run courses every year. It's obviously seasonal, to train new beekeepers. And that's one of the things we're really committed to improve the quality of husbandry, so people who have bees actually know what to do with them and treat them properly. And the second thing we are doing, as I mentioned earlier, we are breeding bees. These are local stocks of bees. We're gradually trying to get back as soon as we can to the black bee. It's difficult because, as I explained with the breeding, you get so many factors into the mix. We're trying to control that. But we are working on it by flooding the area as we can with native black male bees, which seems to be the most effective strategy. But even so, the numbers are against us. But what we have achieved is a local strain of bee, which will live well in the local conditions, is docile, or reasonably docile, and is healthy. So we are producing those normally. We can produce as many as people want in the area. Because what we don't want is people bringing new bees in. A, they'll dilute the purity again, and they'll bring in disease and other problems. We're campaigning for wildlife corridors. Not too successfully with the farmers, I've got to say. But we are lobbying councils to plant wildflowers on wasteland rather than cutting grass. I've got to say, the argument's a bit like talking to the Philistines. We have got a costed model, which they'll all look at with interest in how you can save money. We've got a scheme at the moment with the council. If you think of Williamson Park, Quilmer Road, there's a strip of land there. It's about 1,000 square metres. We've got a scheme this year that will actually cost the council £5,000 to do and save them £14,000 a year. And they said, could we raise the money for them to do it?
Is this the city council?
Yes.
Who should I contact in the city council? Because there's wasteland around my house, which is cut every 2 weeks or so, and it could be much more attractive than just rather scruffy grass.
Well, I wholeheartedly agree with you. Well, I would write, first of all, whereabouts are you?
Abraham Heights.
The current mayor, I mean, I know she leaves in April, but the current mayor came to our apiary last May and has committed herself to supporting this move. So I would suggest, in the first instance, it would be a good idea to write to her as a non-political move. And in fact, anybody who really believes in this, who writes in or lobbies the local councillor, will help. And we're trying to get as many people who are interested in this sort of approach as possible to join in and say, why are you spending our money cutting the grass when we could be growing areas for pollinators?
I guess it's down to the revenue and capital streams that they've got.
Well, that's right.
They don't want to spend the capital.
They wanted to save the 14,000. We had no issue in that one.
Yeah, it's madness, isn't it?
Yes,
but we run our country and everything.
What about British Waterways? Because they have strips of land along by the canals, and those seem to be ideal corridors.
Yes, we have spoken to British Waterways. They are generally sympathetic, but they come up with a lot of technical reasons about maintaining towpaths and what have you. We've spoken to quite a number of people. I mean, National Heritage is very good. They do a tremendous amount of work. The MOD is brilliant in a way. They're quite happy to let their wasteland grow the wasteland. they're not too happy to have beekeepers or anybody else trampling over it. And having seen some of the things they dig out of it, I'm not sure I'd want to do that anyway. But all their firing ranges now have a myriad of wildlife on them. I'd like to see the forage more nectar friendly, but nevertheless it's wild, and they're very conducive to that. The other big landowner, huge landowner, who owns lots and lots of small pockets of land is the Church of England. Unfortunately, it's controversial in that there is a strong group within the Church of England who want church lands left to go wild, and there's an equally strong body who says no, they want to maintain them so relatives can access graves. I mean, with new graves, that's quite an understandable argument. Once the graves get beyond 100 years, it becomes a little more tenuous. But nevertheless, they've got a tremendous amount of land, and there is a movement within there to see what they can do about that.
What about gardens?
Well, yes, the co-op has done an awful lot to encourage gardeners to plant seeds, and that's all welcome. But the real issue is the scale. We really need the large landowners on board to make an impact. Quite honestly, and I don't want to be disparaging, you could get every garden in Lancaster and Morecambe be friendly, and you would still only be touching the fringe. A colony of bees needs about 2 acres of forage.
That network rail.
Come
all the way along the railway.
Well, network rail.
They use pesticides.
They do use pesticides. I think this is a throwback to the steam trains when they always used to keep the embankments. Yes, that's right. The big one is the highway agency, and they are doing a great job. They've really got the message, but they're doing it as they can. Again, I wouldn't want to discourage anybody who's doing a small pocket of land, so I think that's great. What we really need to look at is the pockets of land and how we can connect them up. If we persuade the local council, and we're trying hard, to work out where all their lands are that they could use, and then link them together. They have cycle paths, you know, why not pollinator paths? Alongside the cycle paths. It makes sense to me, but I'm not a councillor.
Excuse me, is this part of the problem in getting people on board, the perception that you are just, as a group of people, beekeepers, just interested in producing pollen, and they're not aware of the economics behind the pollination?
I think I think the big interest in planting meadows has not come from the beekeepers, actually. It's come from environmental groups, environmental people. Certainly Cumbria Wildlife Trust is not particularly interested in honeybees, it's interested in wildlife pollinators generally. And most of the work, the successes so far, have been from these sort of groups. The sort of group that you are as well, for that matter, and your plans. The beekeepers, in a way, are coming quite late to this feast. DEFRA and the subgroup FERA always seem to want to side on the side of the commercial producers. As I said right at the beginning, almost all UK bees are kept by hobbyists. And DEFRA, for example, want us to go on training courses at our own expense to learn how to recognise disease and then tell them, even though they're supposed to have inspectors to do it. They want us to use chemical treatments on the bees, and quite a lot of us don't want to do that. They want us to carry out regular inspections of our bees. Now, as I mentioned earlier, the hive is kept at a constant temperature, constant humidity, constant pheromone levels. If you lift the top of the hive off to inspect it, all that goes out the window. And we know it takes a minimum of 48 hours for the bees to restore the environment in the nest. So when you think that out of every 7 days, two of them are taken up with repairing the damage you've done by the inspection, quite a lot of beekeepers are now turning to the view that inspections should only be done when there's a need to do them, not as a matter of routine. So we are different with DEFRA. I'm not sure I've answered your question. I think I've rambled around it.
No, well, it was there various bodies, the commercial organisation, farmers, the DEFRA, whoever. Is it a perception, a guided perception that beekeepers solely produce honey and they don't register the millions that it is providing to the economy? Because without farmers, which is DEFRA, without beekeepers, there wouldn't be any crops for them to farm.
Yes, the way DEFRA calculate the 400 million contribution is the crops that are fertilised, their value, and the fact that there wouldn't be any of those crops if they weren't fertilised. The actual sales of UK honey are not vast in terms of tonnage. I forget the figure, but it's not a very... Most of the honey sold in this country is imported, purely because we don't produce enough. And that's because the commercial bee farmers are more interested in pollinating than producing honey. And the hobbyist is either, and we've got a huge split in the beekeeping community at the moment, there are traditional beekeepers who keep bees to produce honey, and then there are equally large group who are just interested in keeping bees. I mean, my wife says if my bees didn't produce honey, she'd be delighted. This is messy stuff to extract. It messes the kitchen up for the whole weekend. She goes away for the weekend and I extract. And I'm expected to have it spotless by the time she gets back. So there's a lot of us, you know, would say honey's just an evil that comes with beekeeping.
Can I just ask about timescales? I mean, you presented the statistic that the population's going down by 25% year on year, which would mean that the bee population's got a half-life of less than 2 years in terms of the total numbers. But the other interesting factor is this neonicotinoids. Do we know anything about how long they last within the soil?
Absolutely not. All we do know, again, I'm not a scientist, but our representatives have been to the scientific conventions. The science is inconclusive. But we do know, as a fact, that they couldn't find a control group of bumblebees that weren't infected with the neonicotinoids. So the implication is they last for far longer than manufacturers want to admit. And because they're systemic, they seem to stay in the system, and there's no way of actually dumping them out.
Do you know why they were looking for bumblebees and not honeybees?
Yes, the argument was that honeybees are managed, and if they went for bumblebees, which are not managed, they'd get a more representative picture.
You could get a clean crop of honeybees quite relatively easily.
I'm not sure we could. Given the information about the bumblebees, not sure.
No, you'd have to feed them specially on particular crops.
Well, the argument is, could you actually get the neonicotinoids out of their system?
Yeah.
And you'd probably have to take
new hives set up, etc.
But even then, have they inherited? Is it passed on? Nobody knows.
The poison can't be inherited, surely.
I don't know. I'm not a scientist. I really am thin ice in this, but I'm told it's a possibility. It can be passed through the system.
Okay.
I don't understand this.
Through to the air.
Through the slash pads, I'm not sure it could be, but certainly not genetic.
No,
but it could have.
Yes, the concentration can't be large, though, so through the cytoplasm of one egg into the relative size and the growth of the species.
Can I ask a question about buying honey? Because I buy honey quite a lot, actually. Mm-hmm. But I buy honey which I believe to be native honey. And it says about Pennine beekeepers. And I've always assumed that these people had their own bees and produced their own honey. And I'm sorry, maybe you shouldn't answer this question, but you can speak to me privately. And I'm not buying British honey.
There is no secret that Pennine beekeeping, who I know quite well, I mean, they're members of our club.
And they're amateurs, are they?
No, they're importers of honey. That's their business, they're imported from all over the world. And it's normally labelled, in fairness.
Yeah.
country of origin. So I'm sure if they've sold you honey that it says UK honey,
subject Yorkshire honey or something. You have to read the label.
Read the label.
The label will be clear.
Read the small print.
Yes.
It'll be kind of bottled in the UK. It's
well,
where it's come from.
When I sell honey, there are very strict rules placed on me. I've got to tell you exactly how much honey's in there, which normally means we say a pound and we fill it a bit more. That's fair enough. But you've got to know who I am, what my address is, when I extracted the honey, and which batch of honey it came from. I have to put that in the label. That is the law, and we've had not prosecutions, but visits from people in authority saying your label hasn't complied.
Now that's the our importing study then.
Well, I really don't know is the answer, but I know as an amateur, I've got to do this. I also know that if I produce more than the authorities deem an appropriate amount, they're entitled to come and inspect my kitchen to see if it's up to health and whatever requirements.
So can amateur beekeepers easily sell all the honey they produce, or should
we? Oh, yes.
Yes, so we're not doing them down by buying imported honey?
No, we cannot meet
the demand.
OK. There's no way.
Is anyone testing the neonicotinoid content of honey?
I don't know. I would imagine yes, but I really don't know. They do some tests on honey, because I know somebody was prosecuted quite recently, an importer, for mixing Chinese honey with, I think, some from the Caribbean. They can test where the pollen comes from, or the ingredient part. Equally, there was somebody prosecuted in London for saying it was home-produced honey, and they said it wasn't. But when they tested the pollen, it was all exotic stuff, because he lived near Kew. So his bees had obviously gone in there.
Do you know how honeybees interact with the wild bee, the bumblebee population? Are they competitive? Do they share diseases?
Do they compete? No, they don't. There are over 270 different bees in the UK of one sort or another, and they all have different length of tongues. And because they have different length of tongues, it determines which sort of flowers they can actually extract nectar from. So they don't compete to any extent. Sorry, what was the second part you asked?
Well, disease.
Yes. Again, it's not an area that's been studied too well, but certainly the varroa mite is carried on bumblebees. Wow.
Well, I think what I'd like to say, although we've had quite a lot of negative things there to say, I think the Fairfield Association should be very proud of what we are trying to do to encourage all these wildflowers and environment for the bees. And I personally, again, quite a buzz from that.
As I say, we are fighting back. We've got a lot of new beekeepers who are interested, and what we are finding is the beekeepers we're getting coming forward now are much more interested in the environmental aspect of beekeeping than they are producing honey. That's certainly a very strong trait that we've noticed.
I think you could overcome the farmers' objection. The reason why farmers aren't planting wildflower strips is because the farmers generally absolutely detest paperwork. If you turned up at the gate with a bag of local wildflower seed and 100 quid in your hand, they would most gladly plant those wildflower strips with you if you did all the paperwork for them.
I'm sure that's true. There is a possibility, actually, of us running out of wildflower seed. The commercial producers of that really aren't geared up. The co-op has done a lot in that direction, but it's not that easy to get hold of vast amounts of seed in quantity.
And it needs to be UK species as well. There's so much that we come across where wildflower seed has been planted that isn't the UK species, and that's potentially a big, big problem.
Yes, it is. Mm. It is. I mean, we actually need tons of the stuff, or maybe hundreds of tons of the stuff, and I don't think the capacity at the moment is there.
Where's the problem if it's not UK wildflower?
Oh. That's a hugely controversial point. One of the plants that really has saved beekeeping in this part of the world is the Himalayan balsam. It produces 55% more nectar than any UK plant. It produces it for 50% longer than any UK plant. And it produces it at a time of year when UK plants aren't producing. It basically comes out about August and lasts through till the frost comes. And the springs have been so bad over the last few years that if it hadn't been for the Himalayan balsam in the back end, giving the bees enough food, nectar, to last the winter, we'd have had bigger losses. The environmentalists, particularly those on the riverbanks, detest the plant. It does damage the riverbank, there's no doubt about it. But it's a mixed blessing.
But that's not really, that's not a huge threat. The threat is European species of cowslip, for instance, where you get these massive cowslips that have gone to cross-pollinate with the UK species and ruin the UK genetic base, the Spanish bluebell and the things that are closer are the danger species. The Himalayan balsam, I mean, if you have a sustained campaign and rip it out, because it's an annual, 2 or 3 years of that sort of management, you can actually contain it, and it doesn't cross-pollinate with the UK native. So it's possibly not such a threat as generally perceived.
Well, maybe so. Ironically, the only native balsam to the UK, it's actually not balsam, doesn't produce nectar that the bees will touch.
You said we lost 80 billion bees, is that right? We've lost that number since...
We've been losing about 80%
of
the bee stocks.
But still, having 6 billion sounds a huge number to me.
What
is the number you would like to see?
There was a study published about a month ago which said the UK only has 28% of the bee stocks it needs, when we're not the worst in Europe. I mean, up in China, in parts of China where there are no bees at all left and they have to hand pollinate. And that is incredibly expensive. So they collect pollen in different countries and take it up to China and hand pollinate the plants in the greenhouses.
But does that mean that people want to import more bees?
There's just not the wild crops to sustain them. They want the crops, but they've used so much pesticide that the land's poisoned.
So, in around here, when you say you're training new beekeepers, do you have an idea of a number of beekeepers that this area could sustain? And you're training within that figure?
We probably have about as many beekeepers as we need. Now that the big rush is gone, and in fairness, the new beekeepers we're training are about balancing out the ones that we're losing, because quite a number of our members are older rather than younger, and people in the past have taken up beekeeping rather later in life rather than earlier, although we are getting younger beekeepers coming along now. So I think that's more or less in balance. What we really would like to see is a vast increase in the amount of pollinating forage that we can see. So groups like yours who have got these schemes, it's absolutely wonderful. We're talking all the time about honeybees. Bear in mind, honeybees are managed and therefore supported far more than the wild pollinators. The wild pollinators have been absolutely decimated. Nobody looks after them. They're unmanageable, obviously. Honeybees are perhaps the most cosseted of the pollinators there are. But in a way, it's just, if they weren't the fact that people like ourselves looking after them, the pollination situation would be dire.
How many hives should a hobbyist beekeeper have? Two, six?
as many as the local forage will sustain. That's the get-out clause. What we do say from a practical husbandry point of view, three colonies is about right. And the reason for three is, if you have three and you observe the behaviour and one goes off song, it gets ill, you can notice the difference in behaviour and you know which one it is out of the three. If you just have two and one, they're performing differently, you don't know which is performing badly, so you have to open both up. If you've got two who are performing on par and one isn't, you've got a clear idea that that's the one you need to look at. The bee-friendly approach to beekeeping is keep your inspections down to the absolute minimum. Don't go in just for the sake of going in. Now, we do have some members who get tremendous withdrawal systems if they can't get their fingers into the bees every week. Fortunately, they're getting fewer. So three, I would say, is about the right for an average hobbyist.
Do any of the farmers who are growing crops like strawberries or raspberries that need pollen, because they were asked you to take your hives near to them?
Yes, we have a waiting list of people who say, I've got a huge garden, this, that and the other, I'd like bees but don't want to keep them myself. We don't have many commercial growers of crops in this part of the world, so that's not really an issue for us. But certainly in the southern counties, a lot of our beekeepers there subsidise their hobby by taking the bees around.
And they get paid to make sure the orchard is kept, for example.
Yes, they do. Yes, they do. I can't say they're earning a living out of it, but they do defray some of their costs.
Can you check your hives for that? Is it possible to, if you like, net a few or so coming in and out and check them for disease and mites and sort of thing?
Yes, it is. Statistically, I'm told to do that you need 30 bees, which is not difficult to do. You catch those at the entrance and then they pulverise them up and mix them with certain liquids and then look at them under microscopes. That's not part of beekeeping that I know very much about. And it's very useful to know people who do know something about it. Yes, but you can do that. So the argument for going in every week is, it might be a spurious one. It's very interesting to know what's going on, and it's fascinating to watch them going on. But given the damage it does when you do go in, it's something which perhaps should be kept to a minimum rather than as a routine matter, in my view.
I don't actually know how much you know about us, about the Fairfield Association, but I'm assuming you do know that we have a hay meadow that we're sowing with wildflower seed, and in our new land we're planting borders with wildflower seeds. From what you know, is there anything else that we ought to be doing?
To make it friendly for pollinators, you need to have plants that will produce nectar over a rate as long a season as you possibly can. We have a thing in this country called the June gap, which is quite problematic in this part of the world. We get the early spring flowers starting off, our bees are rarely out to see the snowdrops, but certainly a good year at the crocuses onwards. And then there's a gap from about the end of May until July where there are very few flowers producing nectar. If you could concentrate your plantings on stuff that produces nectar in that June period, that would be exceedingly beneficial. Again, we can give you some pointers on that.
Sorry,
please.
Is there a list? Is there a list available, or month by month as to what should be?
We produced a list that you're more than welcome to have a copy of.
If we could have it electronically,
yes,
we'd understand the website.
Yes. Yes.
And then members can see it as well for what they're planting around.
I'll get our plant expert to send you our list.
I think that would be useful.
Yeah. I'm not saying it's exhaustive and complete, but it's where we are with it at the moment.
I can see us also having a problem then getting hold of the seed to do something about it, which is a different problem entirely, not yours.
It is a different problem, and I fear that might be a challenge.
But we do it by various means, but also by getting hay that has been has wildflower seeds in it from a different hay meadow.
Yes, I understand the process. What I'm saying is there are so many groups now waking up to this that the demand for that is huge.
Yes.
So to make the progress you'd know that I want to do as quickly as you'd like to do it might be challenging.
Our seed actually comes from the AOB from Silverdale. We have contact through the local naturalist group.
Well, if you can get the seed, that's absolutely fabulous.
Great. Just to let you know. Yeah. You know that, yeah.
All I'd like to say in conclusion really is we as beekeepers really welcome and appreciate the things you're doing, and if we could perhaps have a dialogue at some stage to make sure that you're doing what is right for the bees specifically, and we'll certainly help you with that. I mean, the point around about was a classical example. In Lancaster, the council agreed to plant that up. They went to some expert in Sheffield University. Now, I'm not criticising the expert, because the brief they gave him, he delivered. But he isn't nectar-producing plants. It's wild plants that will produce colour. But they're absolutely no use to pollinating by and large. And it's important to get the brief right to make sure that if you're producing plants for pollinators, you actually have that in your spec, and you get plants that will produce nectar for pollinators over a period of time. Because the plants produce various types of nectar at various times of the year, and they don't always produce it consistently. So you need that mix.
Okay, so do you also have a list of native wildflowers which are nectar producers and those which are not nectar producers?
We do.
It's as simple as that?
It's not quite as simple as that, but we do have lists. We've been building them up over the last 3 years. Because we have been planting heavily to our own apiary. We've got 2.7 acres around the apiary. And we've been planting that, and our purists say we've got to plant natives. And researching them actually hasn't been quite as easy as we thought it would. But over 3 years we've built up a list that we're more than happy to share.
Is it also helpful for us to know which beekeepers are in our area, or is that just not relevant to us?
I wouldn't have said it was relevant.
No. Okay.
The bees and the other pollinators will find it if it's within their flying range.
Yeah.
And you'll know whether you're successful or not by counting the pollinators. If you see them there, then it's successful. If you see them there in numbers, it's very successful.
Mm. I think that's been absolutely fascinating, and really you're pushing us an open door here.
Yes.
And we are very interested in getting the lists of pollinating plants, and especially the plants as they go through the season, and we can put those on our website.
Yes.
And then, I mean, by all means, keep in contact with us as an organisation.
We'd like to do that.
I think that's not particularly difficult to do. We have meetings all the time, don't we? And, you know, if it was appropriate, then you could come and talk to one of our meetings when there's a smaller group of people who are making decisions. I mean, that we are very open to having this dialogue with you.
Excellent.
But meanwhile, this evening, I'd like to thank you very much for coming. I think it has been absolutely fascinating. And thank you also for coming. I would like to ask to make sure that everybody here signed the register, because that's the evidence I need to send back to the Lottery Fund. I'm very pleased to see that there are some people here tonight who haven't been to other meetings, which I think they've been specifically interested in the topic. And also, for people who can't come, if you just spread the message around that this has been recorded.
Yes.
And will be on the Fairfield website along with the slides. For me, well, thank you very much.
Can I just make one last comment? If any of you would really like to see inside a working beehive, we do have an open day in July at our apiary at Yell & Conyers, where we open up the hives and you can actually come and get your fingers inside.
Oh, okay.
If you'd like.
If you could send us that information as well.
Yes.
That could go out in the Fairfield newsletter, Ruth. That could go in the newsletter, couldn't it? Yeah, that would be very interesting. Before Yeah, I'm supposed to get cold in here tonight. I think I may want to rush out and get coffee or go home. Could I just mention that the March, that our next meeting, which is on March 6th, will actually be in the auditorium, not in the lecture theatre. And this is because Mike Derbyshire is coming back to us to actually show some original material, which people, I think, will find interesting in itself. This is a local history, I'm sorry, this is a documentary stuff. But also in I think the hope and expectation that some people would like to follow through and do explore further the history of the region. So that will be in the auditorium. On that evening, someone called Ian Sharp will be coming along just to listen to what Mike is presenting, but also to mingle and get to know us. You may have been aware, some of you, that there have been metal detectors out in the fields, and they've come up with some quite, it's not the Silverdale Hoard, but I think some really quite interesting stuff. So we've been talking to Ian about how to disseminate that information, and he will have a session of his own in May, in which he'll bring all the stuff that he's found and labelled and everything, and talk about how they work. But he very much wanted to come along before then, just to meet us. And so he'll come along on March the 6th, and because it will be a relatively informal session, less of lecturing, more of looking, then there will be an opportunity to chat to him there about what he's been doing. So that's March the 6th, and be in the auditorium. And just as a little bit of a follow-on from what we've been hearing this evening, we also have a talk of invasive aliens in May, which I think is going to be about things like Himalayan balsam, which really about plants. And so that will be a bit of a contrast to what we've been talking about tonight. But do please look on March 6th. Don't let me put you off if you don't want to spend time researching the history of the region. I think you'll be interested anyway in the stuff that Mike brings along. But we still hope a few people will do that. Okay, so as
we
go,
I just mentioned a couple of things too.
Sorry.
First of all, in addition to the metal detecting, which is still going on, it isn't finished yet in the big arable field that we're creating. We will, after the land has been ploughed at some point in the spring, be arranging for groups of people to walk over the land looking for things that might have been thrown up by the ploughing, which we will then try and record in position terms. And we're very interested in finding people who are interested in joining us to do that, because it will take some days and we will need some people to do it. The last thing is that I have left on the table there some Fairfield Friends forms. Some of you will already know that we're beginning to form a Fairfield Friends group, which we hope would donate money on a regular basis to the association in order for us to be able to maintain all of the community assets that we have these days. And we already have about 30 people who've signed up to do that in the last few weeks. So it does look as if it will work. If you want to take form, you're very welcome to do that. And Jeff here is the person who's collecting the forms from people, but there are an indicated way to send them on the form itself.
Thank you very much. And if anyone hasn't signed the register, could they please find it on the way out?
It's about 7 of them.
7 people. 7 people have put down.